The time is 9:08 and the date is the 3rd of April. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Present for the record, Senator Stevens, Green, and myself, McGuire. We have six items on the agenda today, which I believe we will get through all of. The first is Senate Bill 228, Municipal Land Use Regulation. Next, HJR 32, Broadcasting Industry. After that, HJR 19, Oppose Federal ID Requirements. After that, HJR 38, Israel's 60th Anniversary. Then HB 193, Police Standards Council Membership. And then HB 252, Leave for Organ, Bone, Marrow Donations. And so first on deck, Senator Dyson, Senate Bill 228. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair, for, and the committee members for hearing this bill. In the years I've been in elective office, I've often wondered and longed for bills that came before me that didn't have dollar signs on them, and this is one of them. This is an effort to continue the long tradition in Western democracies to protect real property, and many of us have lived in communities where are becoming increasingly urbanized, and with that goes planning, land use regulations, and so on. And for established residents who've been there long before the city moved in and around, the cities invariably come up with new, well-intended land use regulations that are to fulfill what the planners and some of the residents want. Ultimately, they can end up trampling on property owners' rights. And what this bill before you does is make it so that if a property owner, if a city or a residents move in around him, and then they prospectively or change the law under the land use regulations, whatever was permitted before he can continue to do, and as long as it's not a nuisance. And in my earliest iterations of this bill, I basically said, if the neighbors can't see it, hear it, or smell it, it's none of their business and it's none of the government's business, leave them alone. But indeed, as we've been in contact with national experts on land use battles, they've said that the term of art in law, which I think you'll see here, nuisance as recognized under common law, is all the protection we need. And I have certainly our state's expert on these ready to testify, but he will explain to you that your property rights never extend to your being a nuisance to your neighbors. And the neighbors and the neighborhood and the community is protected under those common law nuisance laws, and he can speak to that eloquently. I provided you, I hope, in your packet a couple, three pages of quotes from the founding fathers about how important it is to preserve property rights. And the only other thing I would say, well, and this bill makes particularly carves out senior citizens and the disabled to say that if the planners move in around them with new regulations, they have at least 10 years before they have to come into conformity. And certainly it's our intention that whatever was property rights and uses that they had before will continue until the land transfers. And so that's to protect those. I've got cases in my community where the neighbors have moved in and built a subdivision around them, and now the people can't continue to do what they were doing before. And we have subdivisions in Eagle River where you can't drive a pickup home if it has the logo on the door. You can't park your boat or your snow machine in the yard, and you can't even put a sign, including a campaign sign, in your yard, which I think has maybe some First Amendment rights problems. But this, what it does is preserve whatever was legal and permitted before is still yours, unless it's a nuisance. So I'd be glad to hear some questions, and the attorney that's online, if we could get to him early in this with your questions, I would be thoughtful of his time.
That would be great. I think my line of questioning just really goes to, there is a whole body of common law in this area, and so what I'm wondering is what particular situation sparked this need to deviate from that recognized common law, and perhaps is it something that involved a constituent or a real-life situation or a case?
Well, yeah, it certainly involves several of them, but one of the things that you will hear is that most, and particularly with home businesses, that the most of the city planners say, well, you're grandfathered in. And that allows you, but it only allows you to continue whatever your home business was at the present level of intensity. And many businesses need to change and grow as the circumstances change in the environment. And so this extends beyond that and says whatever was permitted before, you can continue unless it's common law nuisance. Yeah. Or until the property transfers. And so that does it. And similarly, if I have quite a few people in the northern area who have a Connex on their property, and these are all 2.5 acre old BLM land grants, and a Connex they have because that's weather tight and rodent proof for them to store their horse or dog food. And as soon as the city finishes its land use regulations, Connexes will be gone. They'll be gone like Quonset huts are. And this would say they can keep that use, which was permitted before, until the land transfer. And also it says that even if you didn't have a Connex on your property, but it was permitted under previously, you can put one. So not only grandfathers you one you had, but the permitted uses before, because some citizen may have moved in and planned on doing that, and then the land use regulations change, and the huge lifestyle thing that they was the basis of their buying that land, in that area it's often horses, and that would be precluded by a new regulation that wasn't in place when you bought the property.
Fascinating. You could see a whole additional amount of market value being added to a piece of property as a result of a bill like this, because there are people I know in my district in particular is largely covenanted. And so you have folks who want to have their RV parked outside, want to have their boat, various things that you can envision, want to have more than two pets, want to have three pets, and can't. So it's an interesting conversation, Senator French.
And if I might respond to that, but maybe yours is view that you just expressed is a real purist one. We haven't got that far.
Yeah.
We have said if the land transfers,
it stays with the original.
Previous property rights do not transfer. The new owner would be subject to the new regulations, and hopefully, and maybe we should put it in the code, that has to be declared to the new buyer. He's not buying the old guy's pre-existing rights. Excuse me.
Senator French.
I mean, this is a fascinating bill, and yet I'm not quite sure I understand it now based on the last couple of statements you made. It sounded like the regulations in place would stay in place until there's a transfer. And then I thought I heard you say, but if connexes were outlawed and you bought the property thinking you could put connexes on there, then you could. And those two ideas seem to be in conflict.
Yeah. And maybe I misspoke. But if you own the property and the city comes along and says...
If you own the property, don't have a connex, they pass an anti-connex law, you can still put a connex on it because your property hasn't transferred.
That's right.
So it's the transfer that triggers the new rules.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, questions for the bill sponsor. Thank you very much, Senator Dyson. We do have three individuals that have signed up to testify. Is there anything else you want to add at this time?
No.
Okay.
But as soon as they're done, I'd like to have this attorney be able to respond to the issues that have been raised here at the table and the others.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Dyson. Bernardo Hernandez with the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. My name is Bernardo Hernandez. I'm the director of the Community Planning Department for the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and I've been working here for about 5 years. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify this morning. First of all, we just want to be on record of opposing this Senate Bill 228. And I understand the sponsor's desire to try to weigh this continuum between the public health safety and welfare on the one hand and individual property rights on the other hand. Because, you know, we're all in this, when we're working with planning issues and zoning issues, we're always somewhere in between these two opposites. And, you know, planning and zoning is really an intensely local kind of issue because different communities have different aspirations, they have different goals, and they have different visions of their community. And at the same time, we know that land use is a very dynamic issue, and we know that people's sentiments that people have within a community is also very dynamic, although it takes place over time. Here in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, we have, you know, our own grandfather rights ordinance. We have home occupation ordinances. And we've been having zoning basically in the Fairbanks area since 1949, and we seem to be doing pretty well at it. Because land use is so intensely local, I think that the local community should be making decisions on what they want with their land use. And it should be done through the public process. And believe me, public process is a big deal here in Fairbanks North Star Borough. And all of these ordinances are very well scrutinized because every ordinance we pass, somebody gets affected. And we need to listen to those people, how they're affected as individuals. And we also listen to the public in general. The public community welfare issues are so important as well. In fact, everybody would agree, for example, that we need to have, you know, the school system. We want to make sure we have, you know, doors or that people can escape during a fire and sprinkler systems, or we want to have street lights that have red for stop and green for go. All these public sentiments are very important, but then the individual property rights are also important. So we're weighing that constantly. So we just want to say that this should be left to the public, the local groups to make their own zoning ordinances, and this steps outside of that. This is an ordinance or a bill that would be created at the state level that really shouldn't really affect what we're trying to do here locally. And in fact, just to let you know, you know, our zoning ordinance, you can have grandfather rights for 10 years, 11 years, 15 years. In fact, you can continue to have grandfather rights in the Fairbanks North Star Borough for 50 years if you wanted to, so long as you don't discontinue that use for a period of 12 months. So, you know, we have our own way of approaching things, and we would like to keep it that way. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hernandez. Question from Senator Stevens.
So are you saying, Mr. Hernandez, that there or I guess I'd rather ask you, is there anything in this bill that you cannot already do as a local community?
Well, you know, this bill goes beyond, you know, like in our ordinance, for example, it doesn't matter who a person is here. We base solely our decisions on land use. So, in fact, we want to stay away from, you know, who or what a person is. We want to just look at those land use issues, and I think some of this bill talks about those kinds of things. So we really want to stay away from that. And yes, no, we can do any of these things that this bill, in fact, we're in some ways much more conservative than what this bill is. But, you know, it varies. I mean, there's, you know, there's differences. So I think our ordinance works just fine.
Okay, further questions for Mr. Hernandez? Okay, hearing none, let's go to Eileen. They're listed together. Eileen Probasco and Lauren Cruer in the Matsu Borough, and I don't know if you'd like to testify. Who would like to go first?
Good morning. This is Eileen Probasco. I'll go ahead and speak first.
Okay, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing us to testify, and I would just like to go on record, first of all, as agreeing with Mr. Hernandez, the Matsu Borough does have concerns about this bill as presented, and go on record as opposing it. for many similar reasons, we do have an existing non-conforming use section in our code that, similar to Fairbanks, it does allow the use itself to continue for an indefinite amount of time, not just specifically listed to 10 years. We do have a concern also about the authority of this being governed by the state as opposed to the local government, because in many cases it's more effective and easily changed on a local level, and the public process is definitely lengthy here in the borough, and we do have a lot of participation when code amendments come forward for public review and incorporation into our code as situations arise. I wanted to quote that this bill is contrary to a longstanding public policy, which is articulated by an Alaska Supreme Court decision, which disfavors nonconforming structures in use, and this was in 2002, CZEC versus Concerned Citizens of Eagle River Valley, and the determination was that nonconforming uses are to be restricted and terminated as quickly as possible because of those uses frustrate a local government's implementation of consistent and logical land use planning. So it's the intent, according to the Supreme Court decisions, is just that, for these to be allowed to continue, but similar to Fairbanks, if the use discontinues for a period of 12 months, then it should discontinue its nonconforming status. The other, I guess it was just pointed out to us that it is redundant. We do have our local nonconforming statutes. It is inconsistent with that Alaska the Alaska Supreme Court decision, and we just really encourage the continuation of the local control of the land use regulations as was transferred to the state or by the state to the local entities. So I guess that summarizes my comments. I would be happy to answer some questions if you have any.
Thank you very much, Ms. Probasco. Question from Senator Gary Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say hello to Eileen and her husband. She and her husband, Pete, were longtime Kodiak residents. She was trained there, and now she's made the mistake of moving to the Valley. It's our loss, entirely. And anyway, good to hear you're still active in that business, Eileen. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. It's good to talk to you again, too.
And your Representative Stoltz is also in the room listening, just for you guys to know.
And just a question.
Yes, Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Does anyone know the name of the Supreme Court case that seems to be in issue here? Ms. Probasco, do you have it handy?
The one that I referenced?
Yes.
I can't pronounce the name. I'll spell it for you. C-I-Z-E-K, CZEC, versus Concerned Citizens of Eagle River Valley.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, and perhaps Larry Albert, the attorney online, might know. Let's go ahead and wrap up the other two folks, and then we'll go to the final person being Larry Albert. Lauren Kruer?
Yes, I'm here. Yes, good morning. I'm Lauren Kruer, Planner 2 of the Matsu Borough. I'd like to just add a couple comments regarding what Eileen just spoke to. Some questions I have are additional, the future complications along with applying this particular bill. You know, something at the local level we have the ability to do are when particular circumstances come along, we use a variance process, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And variance is kind of like the other half of grandfathering, where grandfathering is given, you know, to a general group that would fall under a piece of legislation. Variances is for the kind of loophole circumstances that may come about. And because we've been doing planning at the local level for so long, we've been able to develop this process. There is nothing like that at the state process. So when you take and create a law that deals with planning at the state level and you don't have some of the other pieces to truly implement this, I guess my question to the state is how do you propose to deal with this? And again, just another reason why these types of things are really dealt with at the local level. I guess just to also kind of elaborate a little bit more on, I think, something the gentleman from Fairbanks mentioned, as a planner dealing with land use is about just that, use. It is a tool that we use, you know, to create healthy, growing communities. And when you start to take you know, an individual owner's background, whether they be a veteran, a senior citizen, you know, we start to jump onto some slippery slopes. Each one of those kind of special interest groups has their own representation and have worked through various organizations to get, you know, laws adopted that deal with their safety and their equality. But to put something like that in a land use, you take what kind of keeps land use on an even keel, where we deal about the use of the building and not so much about, you know, the background of the individual owner. Because what is to stop us from, you know, starting to make legislation for single mothers or other various ethnic groups? Where does that stop? So I think an important key into planning effectively and equally for everybody is to keep this a local issue and to remember that planning is about use, not so much about, you know, someone's maybe special interest standing or personal owners. And with that, I rest. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kruger. I appreciate your testimony. Okay, and then we have Larry Albert. Are you there? And did you follow Senator French's question regarding the Supreme Court case that was cited? And if you did, if you could begin your testimony by answering whether or not you've read the case and maybe giving us a little summary of it.
This is Larry Albert in Anchorage. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Good morning.
Good morning, Senator McGuire. I'm looking here. I just found this decision. First of all, let me indicate that I was asked last week to testify by Senator Dyson, and I had no prior familiarity with SB 228 or the issues associated with it. So although I do have a background and experience in land use planning, regulation of private property, constitutional issues associated with regulation of private property, but as far as responding to specific issues that are raised today, I may not be able to answer all the questions. with regard to the Sizek case, I have read that before. I do not, I can't summarize it right now in front of the committee, but I can give a citation. I think Senator French had asked. The lady did give a correct caption. It's a Cizek, C-I-Z-E-K, versus Concerned Citizens of Eagle River. That decision is reported at 71 Pacific 3rd, 845, June 2003 decision of the Alaska Supreme Court. My recollection was that this was a dispute between some neighboring property owners and owners of a subdivision in which there was a airstrip, a landing strip, and the landing strip may have been platted as part of the subdivision, or there was some, you know, status associated with that airstrip. However, a dispute arose regarding the continued legality of that airstrip. Beyond that, I'd have to reread the decision. if the issue generically is how does SB 228 relate to the notion of a non-conforming use in local land use ordinances, I would say that you know, there are two different ways, perhaps, of dealing with the same concept, i.e., that there may be present uses to property, present ownership, and present uses to property under rules that are enacted today, but the local government tomorrow may choose to enact new rules and new regulations, and the question is, you know, how should the existing uses be protected, if at all? And it's my understanding, based on what Senator Dyson has said, the purpose of this bill is to protect existing uses of land which would be adversely affected by new land use legislation. Now, a non-conforming use, and again, I'm speaking generically or conceptually, I agree with the testimony of other witnesses that you have to look at, you know, the specific terms of a local regulation, how it works, what is its language, how does it apply to particular properties. But both a non-conforming use provision as well as a variance provision, my understanding generally, that again requires a permitting process. Here, the feature of SB 228 is that it would be a self-executing, protection conferred upon pre-existing uses of land. If in the absence of SB 228, for example, if local land use regulations were to change in Fairbanks, for example, my understanding generally is that an affected property owner would then have to apply for and obtain, you know, an adjudication favorably on a non-conforming use, and would be subjected to whatever the terms of the local ordinance are that amortizes, if I can use that expression, the period of time in which the non-conforming use is allowed. I'll stop at that point.
Okay, questions for Mr. Albert. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, Mr. Albert, I'd appreciate it if you would explain to the committee the protections that are against public nuisance that are inherent in this bill, and the language about common law is, and what remedy neighbors and communities would have against a continuing use of land that was arguably a nuisance to the neighbor or community, please.
Sure. First of all, the term common law nuisance, or nuisance recognized under common law, has a well-established meaning in the law. For openers, I'll say that the Restatement of Torts, which is published by the American Law Institute, and for those of you who are not attorneys, the American Law Institute is an august body of lawyers convened in Philadelphia, and they periodically publish reference treatises. They've been doing it since the early part of the 20th century that restates the common law. And the common law, going from England, is law that's made by courts rather than the legislatures, i.e. the English Parliament, Congress, or the Alaska legislature. So among the restatements of the law published by the American Law Institute is a restatement of the law of torts. The most recent edition, I think, is 1977. That would be the second restatement. And included in the second restatement of the law of torts is a chapter on nuisance, private nuisance and public nuisance. So any attorney practicing in Alaska or in another jurisdiction could look at the restatement of the law of torts and see a compilation of authorities, court decisions, rules on what constitutes a nuisance, what are the criteria for ascertaining the presence of a nuisance, what kind of balancing factors a court considers in decreeing the presence or absence of a nuisance. Same thing in Alaska. There's published precedent of the Alaska Supreme Court, as well as the territorial courts of Alaska prior to admission into the Union on nuisance. Now, I can't, you know, catalog all of that right now. I have not had an opportunity to do that. But suffice it to say that the term nuisance and common law nuisance has a well-established meaning in law. That's the first thing I'll say. Secondly, the term nuisance or common law nuisance also has a well-established meaning in takings litigation or regulation of property rights. Ever since in the early part of the 20th century, the late 19th century, the United States Supreme Court has recognized that uses of land which were denominated a nuisance were not protected property rights, are not protected under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. And that principle has been continuous from approximately 1880 through the most recent statement of that rule was a decision of the United States Supreme Court in 1992, known as Lucas versus South Carolina Coastal Council. Justice Scalia, writing for the court, discussed the notion of a common law nuisance as not being a constitutionally protected property right, and he elaborated on the point again by referring to the restatement of the law of torts. Does that answer your question?
If I may, go ahead.
Senator Dyson?
Lawrence, if indeed, as in the Eagle River Valley case, the airstrip and the operation of it was indeed both scaring and waking up the neighbors, and Super Cubs powering off, it's got to be pretty loud. If this law had been in place, what would been the remedy for the neighbors or the neighborhood or the local zoning enforcement people to mitigate that nuisance and have it declared a nuisance and then prohibited?
Well, I think you've perhaps answered your own question, and that is that, again, I will answer hypothetically because I'm not familiar with the facts of CSIC, but let's hypothecate that an owner of land or a subdivision with a common, you know, common area had an airstrip, and this was allowed under, or it was not, you know, regulated by local land use ordinances. And over time, the use of this airstrip got to be objectionable to neighbors in the area. And so the question is, what remedy would the neighbors have if SB 228 had been enacted law in Alaska? My reading of the SB 228 with regard to this exception pertaining to common law nuisances is that the neighbors could go to court, or the local government. There's what's called both a private nuisance and a public nuisance as part of the common law. Private nuisance is, as the term suggests, private persons can bring an action alleging a nuisance as to their private interests and their private property. A public nuisance, either private parties or a local government have standing to bring an action declaring an activity to be a public nuisance. But either of those remedies could be pursued, and upon a offer of proof that, for example, if the aircraft activity on an airstrip, for example, were dangerous, if there's an issue about hitting structures, I think that gets pretty close to being a nuisance activity and subject of an injunction. Now, actually, on this type of hypothetical, again, I'm don't have the authority off the top of my head, but I suspect that there may be what's called preemption issues. In other words, the Federal Aviation Administration would have jurisdiction and authority to permit the location and the design and operation of an airstrip. So that's another factor in whether or not such activity would be allowed on private property.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, one more question, and I really appreciate your help on this, sir. One of the earlier testifiers talked about the appropriateness of leaving all these land use controls on a local level, and I'm sympathetic to that. But the reason we've brought this forward is that for our founding fathers, the protection of property, private property rights, was a huge issue. This quote from Madison, he said, "Government is instituted to protect property, this being the end of government. That alone is a just government, which impartially secures to every man that which is his own. It is not a just government, nor is property secure under it, where arbitrary restrictions, exemptions and monopolies deny to part of the citizens the free use of their own land facilities." And it is certainly clear in a federal constitution, perhaps less so in ours, but the protection of private property is a huge issue, and that's why I believe the founding fathers elevated it to the level of the constitution. It was a huge debate. We say Americans are committed to life, liberty, and happiness. It was a huge debate. The original wording was life, liberty, and private property. And what I think is appropriate is for the state to say that the protection of private property trumps planning and zoning for the as long as that property is owned by the person there, and that that the zoning restrictions can only be applied on the transfer of the land, so that the folks who homesteaded there can continue doing what they're doing, and is a legitimate function of government at a higher level to protect those rights of individuals against well-meaning incursion of those rights on a local level. Would you comment on that and perhaps say it more eloquently?
I think you've done an excellent job, Senator, through the chair, Senator McGuire. If I may answer to Senator Dyson, I think you've effectively stated the constitutional principle that we derive from one of the founders, James Madison. I think that the issue here is the role of the state versus local government in protecting private property rights. Both the state, at all levels of government, the federal government, the state government, the local government, have the responsibility to protect public health, safety, and welfare of the people. At the same time, the welfare of the people is manifested in their private property, among other attributes of the general welfare of our country. So I think it's appropriate for the state, in this case, state of Alaska, through SB 2228, to declare that the general welfare, one element for protecting the general welfare is protecting existing uses of land and property rights associated with existing uses of lands against prospective changes in regulation, which restrict and adversely affect and result in a diminution of value of that land. Now, as far as the role of local governments to be sensitive to and responsive the concerns of their constituents, that I think that remains, albeit subject to this protection of existing uses. The local governments, in theory, could try to fashion their provisions on non-conforming use or variance to be consistent with the provisions of SB 228.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to go ahead and set this bill aside, Senator Dyson. I really appreciate you bringing the issue forward. Let's continue to look at it. There is significant local concern, which you could envision, but I like the principle, and let's keep talking about it. Okay. Next up, HJR 32 and Representative Stoltz, who's in the room. And the next after that, we are going to adjust the schedule and go to House Bill 193, the Police Standards Council. Good morning.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chairman McGuire. It's a pleasure to be here again twice in a week. I'm presenting House Joint Resolution 32, passed by the House, now before, I think, the only committee in the Senate. So it's a expression of support for free and open competition of the airwaves. It's those of you that might follow talk radio, some listen to it, some don't, some participate in it. It's a free marketplace of ideas. It's a phenomenon that came about in the late 80s, after the suspension or repeal of the so-called fairness doctrine, which was if a radio station put on one point of view, there had to be equal time for another point of view, mm-hmm. in a free marketplace that in a very competitive marketplace the airwaves are, that just didn't work, and that's why the previous types of talk radio heard. We're often public affairs shows where they talk about new sewer LIDs and things that were non-controversial to fulfill a time block of public participation. It's acknowledged by most that this format saved AM radio from oblivion. Talking to my co-sponsor on this, Craig Johnson, he referred to it as a dinosaur that doesn't really fit in the business model of competitiveness of the news and entertainment industry that broadcasting. The reason it's before you, this resolution is before you, is there are efforts in Congress to express support and to repeal it from different factions. They're actively involved. Senator Durbin, the assistant, the chief whip in the Senate, has said this will be repealed. That's a priority. Others like Senator Coleman from Minnesota and Senator Thune of South Dakota have put in resolutions in favor. My resolution doesn't address any specific legislation. I purposely didn't address the type of content because there's a lot of biased information. In the debate of this, I purposely only address the principle of open and free competition of ideas, whether it's a conservative or an Anchorage markets that some of us are familiar with. There are certainly different types. Some could be viewed and cataloged as liberal, some could be as conservative, and some in between. I didn't want to get into that debate because I don't really think it's that relevant, but it becomes part of the overall larger debate, and I just thought I'd just very briefly air it, but it's because it's out there. But the principle of this resolution is to support free and open competition in our marketplace, the airwaves. And it's I've been on the bad side of talk radio. I've been on the good side. You never know how it's going to spin on a day-to-day basis. But it's probably the last unfiltered forum for folks that some folks view it as the most important level of political and social discourse. Some folks view it as entertainment. It certainly is a popular phenomenon that the public supports through how they've adjusted their dials and what advertisers pay for. So this resolution is meant to, in the most non-pejorative sense, as you see from the tone of the resolution, to not bring in a political aspect to it or to endorse any specific legislation, to only express our support for this avenue that a lot of the folks we represent use to as a forum to participate in, whether through listening or calling in. That's the essence of it.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Stoltz. Questions for the bill's sponsor, Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Stoltz, maybe you could explain the second whereas clause. It reads clearly, but I'm just not quite sure what you mean. I agree it's couched in kind of nice language, but I'm just not quite sure what you're getting at by how the regulations have caused the broadcasting industry to avoid important issues relevant to the United States.
Well, Chair McGuire and Senator French, I think it's just reality. Prior to the suspension of the fairness doctrine, or the so-called, however you've referred to it, you didn't have the type of political and social discourse radio programming. It just didn't exist, because a radio programmer is not going to run a two-hour program if he has to run a perhaps uneconomic two-hour program that same day or that same week that's in the generic sense I'm referring to it. That discourse didn't occur.
Just to clarify, you're saying because of the fairness doctrine, they were afraid that having to put on a program, sort of the counterpoint program, which their listeners weren't interested in, would cause them to just avoid it in the first place.
Chairman, I almost call you Meyer because I sit next to him every day at McGuire. Senator French, I think that's the essence of the fairness doctrine and how it affected content.
Thank you. And just as a follow up, more along the a point maybe than a question, but it's an interesting topic. I don't know much about it. I'm sure Representative Stoltz does. He's an excellent historian with a deep knowledge of these matters. It strikes me that one of the linchpins, or at least one of the difficulties, is that the radio waves are not limitless. The radio wave licenses are actually awarded, and having sort of taken that license, you've now sort of occupied part of that spectrum, and then the issue becomes is does that sort of license require you to, that broadcast license require you to present both sides of an argument, or do you just get to use, having paid for that license and acquired it, you get to use it however you want?
Well, thank you, Senator French, Chair McGuire. It's probably in the earlier days that had more relevance, when there weren't, radio was certainly a lot more important medium at the time. People think of President Roosevelt's fireside chats. You know, President Bush gives one every weekend, and how many of you have ever listened to one?
I never miss them.
And I wonder if you know how many addresses would you speculate President Roosevelt gave during his long tenure? Would you even have a guess, Senator?
No guessing.
He only gave 12, but one would assume, at our age, that he probably gave them every week because of how they were viewed. But it was a lot more powerful singular medium than before. But now we have a much more competitive industry.
Yeah.
But I mean, I didn't mean to get off on an esoteria, but I heard that. I was reading something, I think, and that when that fact came up, I was having, when you think about, you hear about the Roosevelt fireside chats on radio, that he only gave a dozen, which is, that's about one a year.
Yeah, I think it'd be more. Absolutely. Any other questions from the committee members? Okay, Senator Stevens.
This is always so confusing in the terminology, but let me get this straight. You are opposed to the fairness doctrine.
You're unfair.
Chair McGuire, Senator Stevens, I am opposed to reinstating the so-called fairness doctrine because it's antiquated and it doesn't really apply to the existing radio market that's burgeoned with in its absence.
I only say that because sometimes it gets confusing as to
what free elections means, or, you know, fair elections and
clean elections.
What the fairness doctrine means.
That's correct.
We remind ourselves of what the fairness doctrine truly is. I appreciate your comments.
And Senator McGuire, I don't like to get in the argument. I've sometimes call it the so-called, and that's not meant to be nitpicky, but it's an almost an inappropriate title. It's yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Anybody here in the audience wishing to testify on HGR 32? Anyone online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that brings the resolution back before us for any committee discussion. Senator French?
Just as a point of clarification, and for the public that may be listening, this is from a Wikipedia article, and they're not always perfect, but just so we know, from a historical perspective, the Fairness Doctrine was a United States FCC regulation requiring broadcast licensees to present controversial issues of public importance in a manner deemed by the FCC to be honest, equitable, and balanced. The doctrine has since been withdrawn by the FCC, and certain aspects of the doctrine have been questioned by the courts.
Just a little historical footnote. Thank you.
And Senator McGuire, I don't have the tip of my tip of my tongue or even in front of me, but there's actually been a Supreme Court case on the enforceability of the Fairness Doctrine. I'll have that before Senator Stevens, so when scheduling this through the Rules Committee for floor action, that information is available to all members.
Excellent. Okay, is there a motion? Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, I move that we move out to House Joint Resolution number 32. There's no fiscal notice there. With individual...
I'll pay for the postage.
Individual recommendations.
Okay, just the paper it's printed on and circulated to. Okay, any objection to the motion to move HGR 32 with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note? Okay, hearing and seeing none, HGR 32 has moved. Thank you, Representative
Stoltz.
Thank
you very much.
Let me take a brief at ease. Next up on deck, the bill, the only bill that we have in committee today, and that is sponsored by Representative Bob Rosas. Not that resolutions aren't important, folks, they are. But so please tell us about House Bill 193.
Thank you. And you do have a sponsor statement in front of you. I'm not going to read it to you, but I will very quickly summarize what House Bill 193 does. In its original version, House 93 took an 11-member board and maintained that 11-member board and would remove one police chief and one commissioner from the board and substitute them by putting two line officers on board. And that's the way the bill passed through the House. We later discovered that there was a considerable amount of concern over who would be or would not be bumped off of that board and what kind of an effect it would have. And so I was approached to consider the possibility of expanding the board from 11 members to 13 members so that no one would be bumped off, but we would still have the ability to address what my initial concern was with the original bill, and that was an issue of equitability.
That's right.
This was one of the few, if not the only, board that I could find that was responsible for issuing licenses and so also the ability to revoke or suspend a license that did not have peer representation. Mm-hmm. And so that was the reason that I brought the bill forward starting last year, was for that purpose and that purpose only. There have been considerable discussion over, you know, what the intent was. That was the only intent. There was no other.
And fantastic.
So as the bill has moved forward, it's continued to pick up a little more support as it's moved along, and we do believe now that by adding this the two line officers to the bill as opposed to eliminating others, making it a 13-member board, we do believe now that we have considerably more support for the bill than we had before. And the two line officers that would be added, it's very clear in the bill as to the representation of those officers, and it's clearly stated that they would have to have 5 years of experience, and they would have to be officers that would be covered under the Standards Council, and that they would be police officers, probation officers, parole officers, municipal correction officers, or state correction officers. And so those are the parties that would be represented when I speak about the line officer.
And Representative Rosas, did you are you aware of the amendment, the possible amendment that would clarify in subsection 1-4, lines 13 and 14, that it would be one police officer and one who serves as a police officer and one who serves as a, and then the category of probation, parole, correction, and...
Right. I was approached this morning about that possible amendment, and I would not object to that.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, questions for the bill's sponsor, the underlying bill? Senator French, anything?
Just to congratulate him on his hard work. I see a letter here from the Police Standards Council endorsing the bill. That's remarkable, and good job, Representative Roses.
And I'm quite pleased to see that letter being there through the chair. Thank you. I'm quite pleased to see the letter there, and that's what prefaced my statements earlier about that this has picked up tremendous support as it's changed and has moved along. So we were very happy to see that. So thank you for bringing
fantastic.
It up.
Fantastic, and I do want to congratulate you as well. This is the way you work a bill. You've, you know, taken your detractors, brought them into the discussion, and made the appropriate changes. So good job. Okay, we do have any other questions for the bill sponsor while he's here? Thank you, Representative. Thank you.
And I will depart, and if there are any further questions, my staff, Crystal Kieneman, will be more than pleased to answer them and probably could do maybe a better job at answering them than I can, but
excellent.
We like to think that's not the case.
Okay, go do good work on the House floor there. Okay, so we do have three individuals to testify. The first is Terry Verbach with the Police Standards Council. Terry? Morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Terry Vrabic. I'm the Director of Police Standards, and I'll make this brief. We've testified numerous times on this bill as it's come up in different places. You have already mentioned the letter that I submitted to the committee here. We've done some great work with Senator Green in the last couple weeks, as well as Representative Rose's office as we've looked at this. And that's what generated the letter. I've spoken to many of the police chiefs. In fact, we do have a police chief here that will testify shortly, as well as the chairman of the current chairman of Police Standards. I've spoken with the president of the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, as well as numerous top law enforcement commanders who do support this new version of this bill. With that, again, I won't, I've testified many times on this. If you have any questions for me or that relate to the Police Standards Council, I'll make sure I'm here to answer them for you.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Okay, hearing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Chuck Kopp with the Kenai Police Department. Good morning and welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Good morning, Chairman McGuire, Senator Stevens, Senator French. Briefly, I am the past chair of the council. I served beginning 2002 and rotated off this last December. Our experience is that the composition of the council as it was created in 1972 has been a very fair and balanced structure. We have never had an opposition to an officer or a line level personnel on the council. We have had Brian Waldron from Southeast Alaska was an officer who served in a public member position for many years and did a great job. Our opposition was only limited to inserting the labor component onto the council and speculating, because it was written in the bill that the governor would consider officers nominated by labor organizations. We didn't want that to become a tool for labor management dispute, but to keep it fair and balanced in its decision making. We believe this current bill does that. The labor language has been removed, and we're very comfortable with the language of the bill. We appreciate Representative Roses and Senator President Green working with us on that. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Okay, hearing none, thank you very much.
Sure.
And Dan Hoffman with the Fairbanks Police. He is the Fairbanks Police Chief. My apologies, and he is online. Chief Hoffman, are you there?
Yes, I am. This is Chief Dan Hoffman from the City of Fairbanks, and I also currently serve as Chair of the Alaska Police Standards Council. I would just echo the comments of both Director Vrabach and Chief Kopp. That the Police Standards Council fully supports this bill in its current version. We have never been opposed to the addition of rank and file membership to the council. as Chief Kopp alluded, our primary concern was the insertion of labor language, which it seemed was attempting to make this council into some kind of labor management dispute board, which is not our function. But again, the current Police Standards Council fully supports this version of the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for Chief Hoffman? Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here on the audience in the audience wishing to testify on House Bill 193? Anyone online that I've overlooked? So public testimony is closed, bringing the CS back for a motion to adopt. Senator Stevens.
Just a question, Madam Chair. I don't see a fiscal note on this, and here we are. Since we are adding two more members, shouldn't that fiscal note change?
Question. And prior to that, would one of the committee members go ahead and make a motion to adopt E, just so we have it properly before us? So moved. Is there any objection? Okay, so we have E before us and a question from Senator Stevens regarding the fiscal note.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Crystal Keeneman, staff to Representative Roses. Senator Stevens, to address your concern on the fiscal note, yes, expanding it from an 11-member council to 13 will draw an extra fiscal note.
Okay.
And probably an extra
committee of
committee.
Senator Thank French. You.
What does it cost to run the Police Standards Council? Anybody know off the top of their heads?
Yeah, on the record, yeah. Please.
Senator French, through the chair, the fiscal note, as you'll see, and I think I can answer all your questions on that, it's listed as a $10,000 increment. Basically, the only cost for this bill, if this gets passed, is the cost of travel for the two new members. We do approximately 2 to 3 meetings a year. So we were looking at basic travel costs per diem. $10,000 would be a more than fair estimate. If you're aware of our budget, it derives out of surcharges. And since I'm responsible for that, I clearly can say that that's not going to cause us a hardship to endure that additional $10,000 in cost for travel for the two new members.
Thank you.
Okay, so amendment number one that I will propose then would be page 1, line 13, after and chapter and insert the word one serves as a police officer, comma, and one serves as a, and then it continues on. And so to be clear, they represent roughly 50-50, and we didn't want to have a situation where you could end up with two police officers or two parole officers, for example, and no police officer. And so is the amendment, so I move amendment number one.
And just, Senator French. Just as a comment, my school teacher grandfather Harvard is now, he's moving through my body and says, how about, and one of whom
and one
serves
of whom.
As a police officer and one of whom serves as probation officer, parole officer, municipal officer, correct, and so forth.
And I like it. Should we just make it conceptual as well so that the
drafters
can,
we'll
and I don't know if they do Harvard commas either and ands and all that. So we know what the general idea is, to get one police officer and one in the other category. So so I accept that as a friendly amendment. And it's a conceptual amendment. Is there any objection to amendment number one? Okay, hearing and seeing none, amendment number one carries. That brings the CS back before us as amended. Is there any additional committee discussion? Senator French.
Are you ready, Madam Chair?
Yes, I am.
I'll move that CS for House Bill number 193 be referred out of this committee onto the next one, which I hope is the Rules Committee, with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
Okay, and so the motion to move the CS for House Bill 193 as amended, individual recommendations, and the zero fiscal notes onto hopefully rules with a waiver from finance, something like this. Any objection? None. and so it's moved. Thank you, Crystal. Okay, next we have HJR 19.
Nice little piece of work, that one, isn't
it? Yeah, that was actually a good piece of work.
We'll go right to you next, Bob. So HJR 19, and I had to bump his down. He's the rules chairman. Yeah. Okay, and so we've got HJR 19 before us, and Reneva Moss.
For the record, Reneva Moss, staff for Representative Coghill. This resolution is the product, actually, of two legislators, Representative Coghill and Representative Kawasaki. It started out as a very long, I think like 2.5-page resolution, and we've cut it down to focus on just a couple of issues. First of all, the 10th Amendment. States have been regulating driver's licenses for, depending on the source, anywhere from 1908 back to 1903. So well over 100 years, states have been exercising their right to regulate drivers. And Real ID, Representative Coghill feels, infringes upon this state's rights issue. The other thing that really gets under Representative Coghill's craw is the fact that if states choose not to be regulated by the Real ID Act, the federal government doesn't punish the state. They punish the individual citizens of that state through not recognizing that state's driver's license as an ID to go through TSA or to go through customs. That affects Alaska and Hawaii more than any other state. So this resolution basically is just a message to the federal government that we don't feel that the Real ID Act is going to result in secure boundaries. It's not necessarily going to increase the safety of our citizens, and that we don't like the federal government punishing our individual citizens for actions that the state may take. I also have Brody Anderson here from Representative Kawasaki's office. Brody is probably the most knowledgeable person in this building on the Real ID Act, which is another flaw in the Real ID Act, the fact that it was put into an appropriations bill and very few people who voted for it know what's in it.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Moss. Questions? This committee is relatively familiar with Real ID. Thank you. So we'll go to public testimony. We'll go first to Anchorage, Krista Stearns. Are you there, Ms. Stearns?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm here available for questions. I don't have any particular testimony to offer at this time, but I am the Assistant Attorney General that does work and represents the Department of Division of Motor Vehicles.
Excellent. Questions?
What is her position?
She is the Assistant Attorney General for the Division of Motor Vehicles. Is that your area?
Yes.
Who else do we have testifying?
Oh, a bunch of people.
Or anybody else from the departments?
Department of Administration, Kevin Brooks, is here to answer questions as well. And Whitney Brewster from the Division itself of Motor Vehicles.
Thank you.
Okay. So those are our resources, DMV, DOA, and Assistant AG Stearns. Thank you very much. If you could just hang online there, we'd appreciate it. Next, we'll go to Fairbanks. We have some individuals online, and if you could just try to keep your testimony to 3 minutes, the committee would appreciate it in the interest of time this morning. First, I'll go to Gregory Hollis.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Gregory James Hollis. This is how you choose. How do you know HJR 19 has and has an act? Me by me played HJR 19 opposing Real ID Act is the thing. Here you say you have and you have down and down right. How do you know if these Ninana right night down things down in a bucket mean that? Here is Ninana Ice Classic tickets down in what bucket? then find out what's there and what's resolved. If these tickets are down, at down, what are they? They never do resolve there. In the late 80s, no mentioning the year 2002, I received a call from Nenana City, and they didn't give me money. Find acts. I suggest they owe me over $621,000 now. All right, goodbye.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Hollis. Next, John Brading in Fairbanks.
Hey, the bushes.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Brading. Are you there? Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
You're welcome. Good morning.
It is extremely disheartening to see the crumbling disintegration of liberty imposed by the ID Act, if implemented. I, as one of we the people, can clearly see the web spun by this ID Act. Instead of iron bars around me, the code readers that will be strategically placed send out an invisible electronic wave surrounding your body, finding the microchip in your possession, tracking you 24/7, wherever you go, thus imprisoning you in an electronic cell. I thought only criminals wore tracking devices. This Real ID Act seems less of a tool to fight terrorism and more of an instrument to monitor and track and intimidate everyday law-abiding citizens in this country. This is an instrument of totalitarianism designed to maneuver the people into servitude, choking off civil liberties that leads to bondage. I ask you to lead us back to liberty. I support HJR 19, opposing the Real ID Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, Frank Turney.
Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
Madam Chairman and McGuire and members of the Senate State Affairs. I want to thank Maneva Moss for making clarification of the so-called Real ID Act. I'm here to testify in favor of HJR 19 and to send a message to repeal the so-called Real ID Act of 2005. I'd like to thank Representative John Calder for pushing this important rights issue before us, and also Senator Wiliskowski, I hope I pronounced that right, for halting funding. Here in the interior of the Fairbanks City Council and the North Star Borough Assembly and the North Pole City Council have already passed resolutions opposing the so-called Real ID Act. And I just sent you all a resolution that will be introduced Monday by the City Councilman Lloyd Hilling in support of HJR 19 and SB 202 to hold funding and encouraging Governor Sarah Palin to take action. I'd like this committee to explore whether HB 3, that is sitting in Kevin Myers' Finance Committee, can be implemented into HJR 19 and Senate Bill 202 regarding driver's license implementation without infringing on our civil liberties. In my comment, I always support our men and women in the military to protect our freedoms abroad, but I believe it takes more than a soldier to protect our freedoms here at home. All elected officials are sworn to an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution as well as Alaska's Constitution. And our liberties and freedoms are in your hands. And I urge you to pass HJR 19, the sitting in state affairs, and get it on in the judiciary so we can get it in the Senate and vote on it. And thank you. And I appreciate what you're doing here today.
Thank you.
And God bless you all.
Thank you. And God bless you as well. Thank you for your testimony. Next is Brent Ritchie.
Thank you very much. I'd like to be on record as supporting this bill. I think from the issue of security, Real ID falls short. I think Real ID is an overreaction by our federal government in response to the 11 attack and also the so-called war on terror. I believe our nation's security is the responsibility of the military and the civilian police force. Involuntary relinquishing of our constitutional rights to privacy. I also agree with the 10th Amendment argument. I don't think there is any stipulation in the U.S. Constitution which gives federal power to trump the state's rights right to issue their own driver's license or ID. From a fiscal standpoint, I think it's just simply wrong for the federal government to mandate this ID Act without funding. I think it's would be a waste of state resources with little benefit, not only the upfront costs, but also the long-term costs of administrating the expanded system. It's interesting. I did a little bit of research on this topic and read a speech by Jim Harper, who is represents the Cato Institute. He advises the Department of Homeland Security Privacy Office. He also advises the Secretary of Homeland Security on privacy issues. He said in that speech that according to Homeland Security's own numbers, the cost of implementing Real ID on a nationwide scale would be at least $17 billion. And he also gave an estimate of the benefit of the Real ID Act as being only $2.24 billion to $13.1 billion. So from a cost-benefit standpoint, the Real ID Act would cost more than its security benefit. Once again, I just want to say that I hope you can pass this bill out of your committee and send it to the Senate floor, and I support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ritchie, for your testimony. Next, I have Schaefer Cox in Fairbanks.
Yes, thank you for listening to us, all of us here. I would like to go on record as supporting HJR 19. My name is Schaefer Cox from Fairbanks District 7. I would like to, though, call for an amendment or call for the sponsors of this resolution to clarify something that has to do with our presuppositions about the Constitution and objective moral law, rather as opposed to arbitrary sociological law. The Constitution states that it is the highest law of the land. And if that's the case, then what we have is objective moral law, which is the recognition of what already is. If we, on the other hand, have arbitrary sociological law, that's just the whim of whoever is dominant at the moment. And there's some wording in there that tends to validate arbitrary sociological law. So if you look at line 15 there, where it says, after be it resolved that the Alaska State Legislature does not believe the government, and then line 15, should wage war on terror at the expense of states' rights. I would propose that it should be amended to say that the Alaska State Legislature does not believe that the government can wage war on terrorism at the expense of state rights and liberties, because the Constitution has forbidden some of the things that they are doing, and the Constitution is the highest law of the land. That ought to read can instead of should. It reads can if we have objective moral law, and it reads should if we have arbitrary sociological law. And that concludes my input, and thank you for proposing this. Thank you for hearing this. I'm proud of you all for being the champion of what once was in America.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Patrick Dalton in Delta Junction. That's the final person I have to signed up to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Patrick Dalton in Delta Junction here. As was pointed out earlier, the Real ID was on the back of an Iraq funding bill, and it therefore received no deliberation in the U.S. Senate, and that explains why we're where we're at today, having to deal with it. I apologize for repeating a lot of what everyone else says. Proponents of the Real ID have said that it is not a national ID, and in a sense it is not. It is actually a de facto global identification system. It is global, not national. It trashes at least three constitutional provisions. One is our Alaskan right to privacy. A second is the Fourth Amendment to our Constitution, which guarantees us to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures without a warrant. This bill, broad-based across the board, ransacks people's rights to be free from searches and seizures. Every person in America is searched illegally through this without any probable cause. And the last would be the Bill of Rights, the Third Amendment, freedom to practice religion as a person sees fit. The Real ID Act violates the religious freedoms of a large sector of U.S. citizens. It requires a repugnant procedure to people who have a literal belief in the Bible as it is written. It requires them to submit their hand for scanning or to scan their forehead, the eyes in their forehead. Now, if you research in Revelation chapter 13, Christians are expressly forbidden to submit to a numbering system that requires either hand or forehead. So this alienates and is repugnant to that large sector of Christians throughout America. Fortunately now, the light of day is revealing the Real ID Act for what it really is. As a United States congressman has put it, it's the hallmark of an authoritarian society. However, in Alaska here, there is a groundswell of public opposition to this. For example, at the Republican convention, there were two Real ID, anti-Real ID measures that were passed. One was a plank to the Republican Party, and the other was a resolution to the Alaska Republican Party. Those will be posted as officially part of the Alaskan Public Republican Party as of May 14th. And thank you for hearing my comments.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else online that wishes to testify on HJR 19? Anyone in the audience? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that brings the joint resolution back before the committee for committee discussion or questions. And as I mentioned, Kevin Brooks from the Department of Administration, Krista Stearns, Assistant AG, and Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles, are online. Any questions from the committee, Senator Stevens?
Well, I'd like Mr. Brooks' comments on what the administration has on this bill.
Okay. Mr. Brooks.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. In response to Senator Stevens' question, the department supports the resolution. We've maintained all along that it's really a states' rights issue for us to implement and maintain rules that govern the issuance of our driver's licenses. We shouldn't be forced to do things, certainly if they're not funded by federal mandate. But there's many things that make good business sense for us to do, and so we try and strike that balance and appreciate the efforts of Representative Coghill on the resolution and making this statement. Happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Senator Stevens?
Yeah, well, the national organizations of legislators, Council on State Government and NCSL National Conference State Legislatures have both taken strong position on opposition to the funding issue, being forced to that matter of us being forced to pay for it as a state. But they have not really taken a strong position about the issue that we've been hearing so much today. Do you have any thoughts on the matter of would Real ID have stopped the 9/11 terrorists, or would they have moved ahead with their plot regardless of Real ID?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's.
You don't know for sure, but any reflections on that?
My own reflections on that, and certainly our director Whitney Brewster may want to add to it. But it's my understanding is the individuals that perpetrated those acts were able to secure licenses, and they were holding legal identification in the United States, and they had attained that illegally. I've always heard the adage that, you know, people who are intent upon doing something like they're going to find a way to do it. Some of the things that we're able to do that, again, that fall in the category, again, of what makes good business sense, I think can help us. Digital photos instead of Polaroids. Having our staff trained in detecting fraudulent documents. Things of those natures are certainly going to help us close that loop. Would they have prevented the actions? You know, that's speculation. I couldn't give you a good answer on that. But I think there are some good business practices that have come about since 9/11 that don't make us, you know, compliant with the entire Real ID Act, but that are prudent things that the state should be doing. But that would be our choice to do those, and we've taken those upon ourselves. There's another bill that's been in the body, and I'm on the other side, HB3, which is a legal presence bill. It just says you're here legally, and we'll give you a license for as long as you're here legally. I mean, those types of things do help to tighten it, but they don't get to RF chips or other things that are readable without the knowledge of an individual. So, again, I think we look at it as our job at the DMV to try and strike that balance of things that we as a state believe are a good idea to do without, I guess, submitting to federal mandates that are funded or not funded.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Brooks.
Yeah, we appreciate it, too. You guys have, all three of you, really, but you and Whitney Brewster have been really patient with this committee as we've walked through all of the different bills dealing with Real ID, and I think you understand clearly the concerns of the committee and the protection of our state rights, and sort of that balance that I think Senator Stevens was referring to between stating, you know, your overarching goal of protecting our country against terrorism and yet beginning to encroach on the freedoms of the citizens that live here and their rights, and starting really what we feel is sort of this national ID program that begins to be very onerous and really encroach on the state's rights. So we appreciate the fact that the department is mindful of that and looking to that as you adopt your regulations and move forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Anything, Ms. Brewster, anything that you would like to add to the debate today or discussion?
For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. I am here to answer any questions. Just a couple of things that came up in testimony that I want to make sure that the committee is aware of, that the Department of Homeland Security is estimating now that the cost of Real ID will be $3.9 billion. And the issue of a radio frequency chip, the final rule of the Real ID requires a 2D barcode. And I just wanted to make sure as we're talking about this that the committee has the facts before them, and perhaps some of the the Real ID proposed rule did have a radio frequency chip requirement, but the final rule did indeed say a 2D barcode. So I just wanted you to have that information.
That's great. Okay, thank you very much, Whitney. We appreciate your patience as well with this committee. As we've taken up the various pieces of legislation that have dealt on this subject. Anybody else here that I've overlooked after the department's testimony? Okay. So that brings the House Joint Resolution back before us. Is there any amendments or committee discussion, Senator Stevens?
No, if you're ready for a motion.
I am.
Madam Chairman, I move that we move H.R. 19 out of committee with individual recommendations.
Okay, is there an objection to moving HJR 19 out of this committee with individual recommendations? And I guess, yes, a zero fiscal note. Okay, hearing and seeing none, the joint resolution has moved. Thank you very much, Reneva.
And Madam Chair.
Thank you to Representative Coghill. Representative Lynn?
Thank you very much. Timing is good. It's about to gavel down, but I have time.
Great. HJR 38 is Israel's 60th anniversary. Thank you for your patience, and welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you very much, Representative Bob Lynn, District 31 South Anchorage, and I'm here to support HJR 38. Let me tell you a little story first.
Okay.
This whole thing brought to mind. I grew up in East Los Angeles, Woods Avenue, Cross Street, from Garfield High, and next to our little home was a six-plex apartment house. And one day when I was 12 years old, some of the people in that house came outside, started dancing around, started shouting, started hugging each other, dancing in the street. And, of course, I asked my grandparents who raised me, I said, what is going on next door? And they said that the happy people from the apartment house outside dancing and shouting were Jewish families, and that they're celebrating the birth of a new nation that they call Israel. Yeah, well, Madam Chair, I've got to confess at that time that I didn't have a clue what a Jewish family was, what was so special about some place called Israel. And I've got to tell you, I didn't know about a place many of us call the Holy Land and how significant that is to all of us, but now I know more than I did. And so I know that the birthday of the sovereign independent state of Israel was May 14th, 1948, and that was obviously the day that all this celebration occurred next door to my home. That birthday was 60 years ago. And it's kind of a miracle, national birthday, and I do think it's a miracle. And that's what this resolution is all about. And you can read all the whereases in the resolution yourself, and I think there's 11 of them which trace the history of Israel back for some 3,000 years from the historic kingdom of Israel to modern Israel, and it's very interesting reading. As we know, Israel is a bastion of democracy that embraces freedom of speech, freedom of religion, free press, free and open elections, and the rule of law in an area of the world where that's very, very rare. For 60 years, the United States and Israel have shared a very strong and special relationship based upon the Judeo-Christian culture, which forms the basis for Western civilization, and this resolution honors that special relationship. The tiny nation of Israel has been and still is, unfortunately, surrounded by nations and cultures that would devour Israel if only they could. And Israel is a nation of warriors, where the military and an air force that's the envy of nations throughout the world. And the national friendship between Israel and the United States of America is an example of what national friendship and respect ought to be. And I would very heartily request your support of this resolution. And if I may, the bells are ringing for me and my vote.
Absolutely.
If I may excuse myself.
Thank you very much, Representative Lynn. We appreciate it. Okay. Chris Clark, want to offer anything?
I don't think I need to offer.
Okay. Chris is here for any questions that the committee might have, and I don't have anyone. Anyone here in the audience that I have overlooked wishing to testify on House Joint Resolution number 38? Anyone else online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that does bring the joint resolution back before us for committee discussion or a motion. Senator Stevens.
Madam Chairman, I move to move CS for House Joint Resolution out of committee with attached to with individual comments, recommendations.
Is there
the attached fiscal note, zero.
That's right, a zero fiscal note. Is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, HJR 38 has moved. That brings us now to Representative Gabrielle Ledoux and House Bill number 252, Leave for Organ and Bone Marrow Donations. Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, members of the State Affairs Committee, my name is Gabrielle Ledoux. I'm the representative from House District 36. With me here is my aide, Sonia Hyman. And I am going to just briefly tell you what the bill is about, and then I'm going to leave the rest to Sonia.
Great.
So, House Bill 252, it's titled the Richard Foster, Stanley Robbins, and Alex Caesar Donor Act. And it's an act requiring paid leave from employment, from state employment, for organ and bone marrow donation. And pretty basically, the employer, in this case the state of Alaska, is not required to donate to provide more than 80 hours of leave. However, the leave may not be less than 40 hours unless the employee requests fewer hours. This basically would involve bone marrow, kidney transplants. Fewer than 100 people in Alaska are awaiting a bone marrow donation. The The matching rate for bone marrow donors is rare, only about 1 in 100,000 people. There are 30 states who have laws similar to HB 252. 23 of those apply only to state employees. And if you have any questions, you can ask me, but I'm probably going to turn it over to Sonia.
Excellent. Okay, questions for the bill sponsor before she heads to the floor? We can have her committee aide, Sonia, stay. Okay, thank you. Good luck on the floor.
Thank you.
Okay, so we do have two individuals who wish to answer questions and one to testify. Bruce Zelnoritis. Good morning, Bruce. You wish to testify, it looks like.
Yes, I'm available to answer questions, Madam Chair.
Okay, so just questions. So, and we also have Bernadette Anton and Grady Mitchell, Gray, from the Department of Labor, to answer questions. Is there anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on House Bill 252? Anyone online? Okay, so public testimony is closed, and that brings the bill back before us to discuss it. And Kevin Brooks is also here to answer questions. Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Could someone speak to the issue of what is required if you make such a donation, either a bone marrow donation or a kidney donation or any others that this would cover? I mean, how much time are we talking about that it takes you away from your job?
Thank you for the question through the chair. I would like to refer that that question to either Bernadette Anton from the National Marrow Donor Program or Bruce Zelnoritis from the Life Alaska Donor Services. I think they both are very familiar with.
This is Bruce Zelnoritis through the chair. If I could speak on behalf of the kidney transplant process, patients are who are coming forth, who would are donors who would come forth on behalf of a patient would at first approach would be evaluated medically, whether they are a candidate for donating safely to another person. They would then go ahead and meeting that requirement, medical suitability, they would then go about the process of donating blood for matching and HLA typing. This typing is done to improve the outcome of the transplant if the matching is better and that the compatibility is present to prevent rejection or minimize rejection. This process might take upwards of 1 to 3 months, but it doesn't require time away from work. It's only when the donor, who's now matched the candidate, the recipient candidate, goes into the hospital for the surgery to donate the kidney, and that procedure is all done within a few hours, and then the recovery period, which does vary, could be from up to a week, 3 to 5 days, and then maybe more time to recover from the surgery at home. And then the patient would then be eligible to go back to work. And this 2 weeks is, on an average, more than enough time for a person to recover on average.
And this is Bernadette Anton from the National Marrow Donor Program, and I can speak to the bone marrow donation. The initial times would be having blood samples drawn. Again, that would not take, depending upon where the donor needed to travel to have samples drawn, they may be done locally. That might take portions of a day. And then there would be a physical, a lot of the initial screening is done over the phone. So then they would need blood samples drawn after that, and then a physical examination, which would probably take a day from work or at least a half day from work, again, depending upon the location and travel needed. And then the donation itself can happen in one of two ways. One is giving peripheral blood stem cells that involves the donor receiving 4 days of injections and then a fifth day of injection and the donation, which would take 1 or 2 days. The injections don't take much time, but they can make the person ill that they may not feel like coming to work. So for the peripheral blood stem cell, we could be talking anywhere from 2 to 5 days of actual time when the donation takes place. So the 40 hours would be reasonable with maybe some half days for samples. Marrow collection, the procedure itself and the recovery takes, it's a surgical procedure, which would be a day in an operating room, probably discharged that same day, but with pain and need to recover at home, which, depending, again, upon the person's job and the procedure itself, can take anywhere from one day to about a week. We don't see many donors who are out of work more than a week with the marrow donation. Again, if they do very heavy labor, and they might need a little bit more time. So the 80 hours for marrow donation is very, very generous and probably would not be used unless the donor had some unusual complications.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. And I appreciate the comments. Of course, we want to encourage people to do this, I would think. And I think I understand what you're saying is that there would be no leave time for all of the preliminary. I think both of them have said that. For the preliminary issues of evaluation, donating blood, taking blood samples, screening, physical exam, if I'm right there, let me know. The only issue would be covering is when someone actually goes through the actual process of in a hospital for surgery in terms of the kidney, and for the other issue of bone marrow donation during that stay in the hospital, too. Am I right there?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens. Actually, the current version of the bill would permit paid administrative leave for a screening process to determine whether an employee is a compatible donor. That is the current version of it. That's the House State Affairs Committee substitute version.
And can you explain that, the screening process?
I gather that there has to be some testing done to determine compatibility with the person who needs a transplant. Again, for more technical details, again, I'd like to defer to the experts that we have on board about that.
Again, this is Bernadette. I can speak to Merrill. Generally, our donors are recruited onto the registry, and at that point in time have their initial screening done, and that's usually done at a community drive, might be a blood drive at work or something like that, but that wouldn't be time that would fall under this bill as I see it. But then once they are a potential match for a recipient, they would be called for probably additional testing, maybe needing to go to a physician's office or to a lab, or even to the donor center to give more blood samples. That could take that. The way I read the bill, that would fall under the bill, but it wouldn't take a whole day unless they had excessive travel time to go somewhere. So it would be going and getting a sample drawn, maybe a couple of hours. They might need to give an autologous unit of blood. I missed that piece before. I'm sorry about that. If they're giving marrow an autologous unit of blood prior to the donation, if they actually match the patient, that could take a portion of a day, again, depending upon where they need it to go. And then there is the actual donation procedure, which I described.
Okay. Could you,
Senator Stevens,
just follow up on that? Could you tell us, I mean, this sounds to me like it may either be painful or life-threatening. So this is not simply a matter of someone choosing to get a few days off by doing something like this. I mean, you are yourself going through a considerable cost and time and pain, probably. Is that true?
I would agree with that for bone marrow and what I know about kidney donation, but I can let the other gentleman speak to that. Yes, these people are dedicated and really wanting to help another individual have a better life.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions for the Department of Labor or Bruce Zelnoritis or Kevin Brooks? Further committee discussion? Senator French.
I'll just point out that there's a whole series of zero fiscal notes attached to the bill from each of the departments, yeah, indicating their belief that there's a extremely small number of people that are actually going to be able to take advantage of this opportunity.
Okay, is there a motion?
If you're ready, Madam Chair.
Senator French.
I'll move that CS for House Bill number 252, State Affairs, be passed out of this committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal notes.
Okay, is there any objection to the motion to move House Bill 252, individual recommendations, zero fiscal note, out of Senate State Affairs? Okay, hearing none, it has moved. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.
Thank you very much.